From WXXI News, this is Weekend Connections, the podcast. Thanks for joining us. I am our silky-voiced host. I've got a little bit of a voice thing.
Can you tell? That you were just singing I've never heard in my life.
I've got a rich baritone. It's like a 90% cacao in the voice today. Do you like that?
Sure. Let's just do the podcast.
We should probably just do the podcast.
It's Friday.
It's Friday, and the rich baritone is here, along with the happy alto.
Okay.
I don't know what you are. You're normal today.
I'm Megan Mack.
I'm Evan Dawson. Yes, yes. Well, we should probably open the program with a question about drugs, really. And it's really actually about pain. Nearly 20 million Americans suffer from high-impact chronic pain. I'm not just talking about pain that's kind of like on a daily basis. It's the kind of pain that could derail just getting out of bed. Many use opioids to manage that kind of pain, and you don't need us to tell you that there's a national opioid crisis. The majority of patients don't become addicted, of course, but some do. And Senator Kirsten Gillibrand is running for president. She's proposed a plan to deal with the crisis.
Her plan includes a limit of 7 days for opioid prescriptions. Those are for acute pain. But Gillibrand says she would not limit prescriptions for chronic pain. We talked to our WXXI colleague, Laura Garrison, who has lived with chronic pain for decades. We also talked to Dr. Michael Mendoza, the Monroe County Public Health Commissioner. Let's listen.
I continue to take opioids on an as-needed basis, but of course I've been educated by my doctors to realize that that should not be the first thing I do when I feel pain. There are other methods that you can use, and exercising and all kinds of things that you can do in order to stop that pain, and that opioid should be your last resort medication.
It's in break glass in case of emergency?
Sort of, yes. Okay. Exactly.
Okay. But it's still central to at least to have that tool in your life to
I
maintain
do
quality
it is.
Of life?
Yeah. Right. Because, like, there are times where I cannot sleep at night. So after, like, say, 6 or 8 Tylenol or something like that, and I still can't sleep, and I am in such pain that I'm just walking around because I cannot stand the pain, then I take an opioid. But otherwise, I don't know that I could be working. I don't know that I could be doing all the things that I like to do. I love to travel. I'm out there all the time. And I do feel that it is part of the overall picture of what you have to do. And if you go to things like end-of-life issues, my father suffered also from arthritis and all kinds of things. And towards the end of his life, he was in constant pain. So he took opioids regularly, every day, multiple times a day. But he was 93. And truly, if he got addicted, you know, I don't know that that's such a horrible thing.
Senator Gillibrand, though, I mean, I can't speak for her, but she would probably say, I'm hearing you, but this legislation is aimed at acute and incidental kind of needs, not chronic long term.
Well, I think that you're going down a slippery slope when you start legislating things, because I hear her saying that, but then the next step is that you have doctors who are not prescribing. I already have not great difficulty, but difficulty getting any kind of serious narcotics. What I'm taking is basically Tylenol 3 or 4 so that it's not anything really heavy duty. And I'm okay with that. But some people, that's not enough of medication for them. And even the last time I went into the office, they are randomly drug testing almost every patient who goes in there too. So it's really interesting how the doctors are reacting to the whole opioid crisis. And I think that the doctors, we can take care of it. And through good public health education and through education of the general public, I think that this is something that can be taken care of. And you can see the statistics are showing that it's improving. I mean, believe me, there's still a crisis. We still have a problem. But I think that legislating issues that really should be between a doctor and a patient, it's really tough. I mean, we're having the same issue, and I don't want to start bringing this up, but like an abortion where, you know, okay, so this is okay. Then, okay, well, maybe that's not okay. Maybe we should go to this. So I think that the minute you start legislating what you can or can't do in pain medication, it creates problems.
Dr. Mendoza, the proposal by Senator Gillibrand on that 7-day limit, does that make sense to you?
Yeah, it makes sense. I think that's consistent with a lot of the guidelines around acute pain management. And as you mentioned, you know, the devil's in the details. And, you know, I would think that with any, you know, regulation like this, there's always going to be an exception, and you should be able to override if needed. This is really, I think, intended to sort of create a starting point for people. And then, you know, you got to use your clinical judgment. And so the way we treat individuals like yourself or any of my patients has to be individualized to the particular circumstances and that person's condition and so forth. But when you look at it on a population level, which is, you know, my primary concern, you know, I think there's good logic behind legislation like this.
Okay. Now, Laura is saying, you know, she has needed it 4 years, doesn't take it every day. At one point was taking a lot, never became addicted. Not sure why she didn't get addicted. Is that in the DNA? Is that just how we are built?
You know, we know that addictions, you know, origins are complicated. There is a good bit of it that's genetic, and we have no way of knowing. And it sounds like you've done very well with that. People exactly in your circumstances have not done well, and we have no way to know. And, you know, that is the challenge that we're facing. And, you know, I've been in this long enough to see the pendulum go multiple times back and forth. You know, we've got to figure out the right happy medium. And I think, you know, we're still kind of going back and forth. But I do think it's not a choice. You know, you to have addiction or to not have addiction, it's not that you wanted it or anybody wants it. You know, it's
same
one
thing
of those
with alcoholism.
Things. Absolutely.
Right?
It's a disease. And, you know, nobody wants to have diabetes or heart failure. You know, it is a very complicated disease. And, you know, I think people who are struggling through it need compassion and help.
Next, we sat down with local teachers who just wrapped up their first year on the job. According to national data, the profession is not as popular as it used to be. Statistics from the U.S. Census Bureau show 22% of college students majored in education in 1975, but in 2015, fewer than 1 in 10 students pursued the major. Many teachers say society doesn't value their work.
Well, despite that, the local teachers we spoke with say they have found their calling. Dr. Susan Spencer is a science and math teacher at Rochester Prep High School. She changed careers after she realized she wanted to be a teacher. Carrie McCree is a Rochester City School District graduate who now teaches English Language Arts at school number 12. Both joined us to share their experiences in the classroom. In this clip, they discuss their best and most difficult moments on the job. Here's Carrie, followed by Susan.
My best moment probably was when I was working with a student that I noticed her behavior started to change a little bit in the classroom and take a turn for the worst. And so I pulled her aside, I talked to her, and I really found out what was going on. And I was so surprised how much she was willing and able to open up, you know, with me about some of the struggles that she was facing at home, which made me really, you know, think about these kids are full people and they have a lot of obstacles that they may be, you know, challenges that they may be facing at home. And they do bring that to school with them some days. So every day for a kid is not always a good day. And, you know, when we have 28 kids in a classroom, we have to be very much so in tune with what's going on with all of their personalities and some of the challenges that they may be facing on a daily basis.
What happened with her?
She just revealed that she was having some mental health concerns, and I had no clue that this was something that she was struggling with. And so it made me become a lot more sensitive to maybe her needs and figuring out ways to give her time if she needed a break from the content or just to take a walk or get a drink of water. And so that was an important revelation that I made by making that connection with her.
What did you see the impact from that moment, from that day through the rest of the year? Did things get different? Were things
so
different
much
with her?
Better. Yeah. So much better. I mean, she asked if we could meet and talk again. And I really felt like I was able to make an authentic connection with her. And I noticed that she put more effort into her work because there was an understanding that we developed between, you know, each other.
And now I got to ask, did you have hard, again, you don't have to name names or anything like that, but did you have hard moments that made you feel frayed or questioning your work?
No, I think every day is a challenge. And so knowing that I'm walking in the door and there will be some obstacles that I'm facing, for me, it's just a matter of taking a step back and figuring out how to address that challenge or overcome that obstacle. And anything, you know, that's worth having is, you know, going to have some sort of challenge. So in this career, I think that it's an expectation, but every day is a fresh day and a new start.
It's a wide range of parents out there in terms of their involvement, how engaged they are, how helpful they are, how courteous and respectful they may be of their children's teacher. Generally speaking, what message would you send to parents?
Stay involved as much as you possibly can. and just know that, you know, the kids are sometimes dealing with things in school that the parents may not even be aware of. Sometimes they go home and they are playing video games and not really communicating as much with their parents. And so we may see things that are going on, and we may phone calls, just pick up the phone, you know, email, make sure that you're accessible to all of your, you know, children's teachers.
Susan Spencer is an algebra and geometry teacher at Rochester Prep High School. Give me a moment in your first year teaching that really rocked you or was really hard.
There's been a lot. I have one young lady who, she's listening, will know who this is, who lost a significant number of family members to a variety of things and really struggled at school. And it was heartbreaking. It's the type of thing that if one of my daughters was going through, I would be devastated and doing everything I can. So there were multiple moments like that. And, you know, the silver lining is that the kids felt safe to come and problem solve with me, to try and figure this out. Like, what do I do? How do I cope with this? What does this even mean that this is happening? But it's very difficult. There are amazing young people, and you want everything to go so well for them that when the world knocks them down a little bit, sometimes you just don't know what to do.
Does our society judge kids too harshly without knowing what they've been through?
Yes, unequivocally, yes. Especially the way that society judges teenagers. If you've forgotten what it means to be a teenager, the amount of cognitive development that is happening at a really rapid pace, physical development, emotional development, hormonal changes, I'm not going to go into everything, but like they have so much going on just from a biochemical perspective. And then you put them into environments that if you've forgotten about or you've never even visited, you don't know what these environments are, then yes, you're going to be hypercritical of a kid who takes a couple tries to pass a Regents. But you don't know that the success that he starts with that day is that he got to school, period. He got there. And that was a huge success for him just because of what he had to walk through to get to the school.
We'll end the week with a moving conversation with two local transgender women. Amy Stevens and Penny Sterling met on Connections in October, and since then, they've become fast friends, and they've helped each other through their transitions. Next month, they'll launch a podcast that explores transformations in life, and those include the transgender experience and transformations in society as a whole.
It's called Transformation Thursdays, if you want to check that out. And in this clip, they discuss how they respond to people who either don't understand how to address someone who is transgender or who discriminate against them. First, here's Penny, then you'll hear Amy.
Context involves where you are and how comfortable and safe you feel. I remember one time I was like walking out of a coffee shop and a guy opened the door for me as he was coming in as going out, and I walked past him. I said, thanks, and he propositioned me. It was like Wednesday afternoon at 2:00, and he propositioned me. And, you know, I responded in a flip and humorous manner, and I posted it on Facebook. That was, you know, it's like, that was really bizarre. I now have a part-time job in a service position where I'm helping customers. And I remember one time I was helping this one woman with her family, and then they wanted off to do other things in the store. And I took a break to go to the bathroom, and I went to go to the bathroom, and the woman had posted her daughter outside the door of the bathroom when I was trying to go in. And the girl said, "Mommy says you can't come in here."
Oh boy.
Yeah, that one got me. And I've had people that I've dealt with that, you know, I'll be helping them and they'll say, and going over the order with them, "You want this?" And I'll say, "Yes, sir." And I'll say, "Please don't call me sir." And then "You want to do that?" And "Yes, sir." "No, please do not call me sir." And then
do they do it maliciously?
No, they just do it. Well, sometimes they do, sometimes they don't.
Okay.
But when I say please, and or on the phone, because I know I have a dark voice, I will get a lot of sirs, and I'm like, I'd rather you didn't call me sir. I do it as gently as I can because I understand on the phone, but in front of me, it's like, "Yes, sir. No, please don't call me sir." And I like the third time, I'm like, "Please do not call me sir." And they go, "Why do you have to be so uppity about this?"
Ooh.
Yeah. Or then the other ones who deliberately are like yelling at me and like, you know, just angry that I'm helping them because I am transgender, and they ask for the manager and they say, "I don't want him to help me." I've had that happen. That one really hurt. That one was like, you know, where they're just doubling down on the fact that, no, I am not who I say I am. And I and he should not have to call me and honor my basic existence. Something like that really, really hurts. Mm-hmm. Because first off, I'm in a service, but I can't even retaliate. So I just have to take it. Mm. So,
and that's the big thing here. So kind of bringing that back to a personal level, yeah. In my situation is, well, I haven't lost, maybe my friend group is going to change and evolve, and that happens through life, especially through a big situation like this. But, you know, I did lose one set of friends that were really close to me, specifically because, you know, the family doesn't agree with the transgender philosophy.
Philosophy.
Lifestyle. It's another lifestyle. Yes. Yeah. It's just your lifestyle. No, yeah. It's not.
So if I decide that I want to go over and spend time with them, I can do it if I dress male, act male, and take on my old persona. But Amy's not welcome. And that was made very clear because it's weird. It's different. They don't know how to explain this to their kids. I told my child in about 10 seconds, she's like, do you still love me? Yep. You going anywhere? Nope. Okay. What's next?
Yeah.
You know, it's not that hard.
Tell me the most rewarding part about having made this transition and despite a society that occasionally can be cruel. Penny?
I'm able to display emotion much more freely and much more regularly, which has helped me navigate so many things in my life that used to confound me because I would just respond with rage. I'm able to love the way I want to. I'm able to express myself the way I want to, both in the way I dress and the way I move, the way I walk, the way I talk, the way I think. It was always antithetical to the way I was performing as a man. I don't know if there's just one thing that I could narrow it down to. It's just a lightening of spirit that has allowed me to smile more and be more joyful. And I've always wanted to be a performer. And I got my degree in acting, but the only thing I could do would be like rage and comedy. I had no ability to express anything else. And it's just amazing that after I transitioned, I am able to, I'm writing my third show. I'm touring the country. I'm, a media presence, for crying out loud. All things that I wanted to be, the person that I wanted to be is intrinsically tied up with the fact that I get to be the person that I am. I couldn't be the person that I wanted to be and be a man, apparently. I had to actually transition before I was able to actualize and realize the dreams that I've wanted my entire life. If that makes sense.
Yeah. Amy?
I think for me, all what Penny says is something, but one thing I've noticed since I've started coming out, and especially in the last year as I've started to reconnect with different friends, is I've always been, before I transitioned, I was considered one of those guys that had a lot of friends who were girls. But now those friendships that I've made with, my girlfriends are a lot deeper. They're a lot emotional. They share different things with me and different parts of themselves with me now that they would never have shared with me before my transition. And I have found so much joy and love in those relationships that's become really the bedrock of, my foundation of where I jump off from now, because, Penny's been, 4 or 5 years now?
Yeah, we've slowly become fast friends.
Yes, we have. And so over, but as you said, last year at this time, I took my first HRT,
treatment.
Yeah. Words escape me today for some reason. I'm starting to get a little emotional. So, and then we were on here in October of last year. I was still very part-time, and now I'm here full-time every day being out and having my life as I want it now. And it's just so normal.
Yeah.
How fast it's become normal. I wake up, I take my shower, I do my routine, I put on my makeup, I put on my dress, I go to work, I do my stuff, and I come home and I do everything in reverse.
And that's another edition of Weekend Connections, the podcast. You can hear Connections every weekday afternoon from noon to 2 on WXXI AM 1370, WRUR 88.5 FM, and WEOS, that's Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM throughout the Finger Lakes region.
We are also on the WXXI mobile app. I feel like I should ask you to sing a song to take us out of the podcast this
Swing
week.
Swing low, sweet chariot. Coming for to carry me home.
He's Evan. I'm Megan. Have a great weekend, everybody. We will
when
talk to
Megan
you Monday.
Megan went to Egypt land. Let my Megan go.
Bye.